Today is the solar eclipse. I think it's the solstice also. The Indian sages have said that whatever spiritual activity is undertaken on a solar eclipse gets multiplied 100-fold. So it is said. So traditionally, they would encourage the Indian people to enhance their practice of, let's say, mantra japa, contemplation, because the practice gets magnified immensely. Now, satsang is one such practice. Sat sang, the company of truth. What has brought us together is satsang, where we are looking beyond the pleasures and pains of life and trying to get insights and understanding of what is actually going on. Satsang also translates as noble company. You see, one beautiful aspect of satsang is we are all drawn by the same thing. And therefore, the masks that we normally wear, the masks we all wear because we have an image we wish to project to people socially and so on, in satsang, that mask is put down for some time. Why? Because what mask is needed when one is in the company of spiritual teachings? So, this compulsive habit of wearing masks is set aside during this brief time that people come together. And that is why in India, in the traditional satsangs, the group which formed around the master, for example, they would refer to each others as Guru Bhais and Guru Behens, Guru Brothers and Guru Sisters. Now, what does that mean? Guru is consciousness. So, Guru Brother means your fellow traveler on this journey, the journey back to the source, discovering consciousness in its splendor. Guru Behen, Guru Brother. That is what is in common now. So the bond is quite different from the bond you share with friends. Some friends, when you were young, your school friends, college friends, you may still have. Some people will find that they no longer resonate with those school groups and college groups because they have changed. Some people feel they have to put on a mask to their extended families whom they don't really like. But this spiritual bond is a very different quality and a different flavor. It has a depth. You needn't know each other's past, preferences, and so on and so forth. So the dynamic is different. It is fresh. So we are here in satsang. During the solar eclipse is a beautiful gift. And we are chanting mantras which directly impact our lives. What are these mantras? These are non-denominational. These are not aligned to specific religions. This too shall pass is a mantra, isn't it? That becomes the mantra of your life. I keep saying, your own life experience is everything comes and goes. Pleasures come and go, pains come and go. You have seen it. This too shall pass. What affected you 5 years ago, which was so important, has lost its importance now, and something else takes its place. Not only is everything in life transient, your own life is transient. So this too shall pass translates as an understanding. In life, mantra. Mantra means man, mind, tra, freeing the mind. Would not a deep understanding of this too shall pass free the mind? Would not the mantra that nobody truly does anything? Because there is one primal doer, one force behind it all. Would not living this understanding be a mantra? Would not acceptance of God's will be a mantra? So this teaching becomes a living teaching. It is not just a mental repetition which goes on in the head all the time without any impact on your daily life. You see, I could do the Om Namah Shivaya jap on my mala throughout the day, but my daily living is a mess. My relationships are a mess. My peace of mind is a mess. This teaching gives the gift of meditation throughout the day, not just as a practice. So satsang is not to be taken lightly, because we all are here because we have realized that whatever breaths are left between now and when the body is dropped, at some point the realization has happened that there is more than this apparent illusion which we are driving through till the last breath. And then that becomes the holy breath, when the thinking mind of the ego is no longer operating That is the holy breath. We are, after all, united by our breath. We all breathe in and breathe out the same air, the same prana. That is how united we are. Forget the rest. What unites us is our breath. Ones you don't like and don't get along with, that is how united you are. So better to understand this than take the hatred to one's grave. Now there is one point, perhaps only this one I'd like to share today, because it comes up very often and it is a very nice way to look at this understanding, which is the difference between a reaction and a response. What is the difference between a reaction and a response? Some people say, most of us, I just react. I can't control it. I can't help it. I wish I was not so reactive. I wish I could be more calm and composed and give the appropriate response. It is a very important distinction. Now, the first thing to say is that in one sense, there is no difference between a reaction and a response. You cannot do anything to convert a reaction to a response. Now, can a reaction change to a response without your doing anything? And the answer is yes. But what does it mean? Now, when we look at our reactions to people, for example, it is, you could say, almost involuntary. Someone says something which we don't like and immediately we give an answer back. That reaction, one could say, is unconscious. In what sense? It is based on all of our past conditioning, how we were treated as children by our parents. Supposing we had parents who constantly said, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this. We grew up with that conditioning, you see. So the minute somebody tells us, don't do that, don't go to the market on Sunday, the rebel comes out. I will go. You can't stop me. The person's intent must have been completely different. He must have had a reason, because there was trouble in the market or there was something, some chaos. But your trigger is based on what happened in your conditioning. Now, all your life can go by just reacting, 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 reacting. Anything you don't like, you react. So many people tell me, we don't like being told what to do. So we react. Now, let's see what happens with this teaching. This teaching shines light on the fact that nobody truly does anything. So when you accept that the person in front of you is saying what they are saying based on their conditioning, based on their genetics, based on how their parents treated them, you start literally seeing them in a different light. You don't take things as personally as you used to. You used to take it that the other is attacking you, and you have to defend yourself. The ego has to defend its fortress. The walls of separation that it has built come up immediately, and all the soldiers are put on guard. That is what the ego does. This is me. How dare you threaten me and my existence? Take a simple example. Whatever your name is, let's say you are at a party and you're introduced to someone with your name, and someone calls you by another name. People get offended. That's not my name. My name is so-and-so. There's so much offense as a reaction. My name is Gautam. Please don't call me Gaurav. My name is Gautam. How quickly we react. That is how identified we are. I'll tell you something quite funny. I was at a tea party. We had published a book, and the author's friends had thrown a tea party for her, to which I was invited years ago. One lady had a most beautiful story to tell, which I've forgotten, but I was so engrossed in listening to her story. She was talking to me one-on-one. Now, throughout her conversation, her monologue, she kept calling me by another name. But I thought it is so irrelevant to correct her because her story was so engaging, I was engrossed in it. So I didn't even bother to correct her, you see. And then she walked off. And after 15 minutes, she came back. She said, how can you not tell me that your real name was Gautam and I've all along been calling you something else? So I told her, look, it's actually irrelevant because I was really enjoying your story. So it's fine. But we take offense at such small things. Our guns come out, our swords come out. So please look at this part of the personality, which got created not by one's own doing. That is the way the ego has been formed, by the same source. But the understanding comes to shine this light that this whole action-reaction loop which one is stuck in because of this ingrained sense of doership, this is causing suffering. Then what happens is the reaction becomes a pure reaction. So I often give the example of Nisargadatta Maharaj, the sage, who was prone to have a short fuse. That was his nature. He was prone to that. And so sometimes he would flare up in the satsang, if you please. And the example I often give, what Rameshji said when he was there, and a man asked Maharaj a question, and Maharaj looked at him with very sharp eyes and said, you have been coming to me for so long and you're asking such a stupid question. Anger arose, and the man bowed down to Maharaj and said, Maharaj, what can I do if God made me stupid? And Maharaj burst out laughing. That is a pure reaction, you see. There are no concepts, I should not get angry, it is wrong to get angry and all that. But the anger that arose in the moment was not held on to. A story was not created out of it. And so whatever the next moment presented, in which case there was laughter because of what this simple man said, Maharaj laughed the loudest. He didn't have to wear these masks that, oh, now I'm angry, now I should act as if I'm really bugged with this guy. So that reaction is a pure reaction. So in our own daily lives, let's look at these relationships. It normally happens with family because they are around us all the time, or spouse. Friendships also. As they say, we hurt the ones we love the most. What is triggering us? What is pushing our buttons? And you will find that perhaps there's a reaction again. And then the teaching comes in and says, hey, look. Look at it now in this light. And you say, my God, yeah. My reaction has been based on my past conditioning. And what happens? You feel like going and apologizing to the person. I'm really sorry if my reaction hurt you. I didn't mean it. Earlier, you may not do that. These changes start happening. You may go and say, I regret it. Regret may arise. But you will not feel guilty or ashamed of what you did, because you too have the understanding that your reaction is based on your own genetics and conditioning over which you don't have control. So certainly regret can arise. I said something to someone I love, and the regret leads to an apology. And then the matter ends there. That baggage of involvement is no longer carried. That is what starts happening. That is how the reaction loses the involvement in the reaction. And you will find more and more that this is what starts happening. As the teaching goes in deeper and deeper and deeper, all these things come to light, literally come to light. One can see this past pattern of conditioning has shot up. One is looking back from behind and can start seeing all these things. So it is the teaching that converts the reaction to the response. You cannot do it. The more you try, the more effort you expend, the further it takes you away from peace of mind. The intent is noble, but allow the teaching to do its job. And you will find, when you look back one day, that my God, 2-3 years ago, these were the things which triggered me, and today I'm a different person. It's when you look back that you realize that gradual change has taken place. I received a very beautiful quotation of Anandmayima this morning. If your desire is intense, she is referring to spiritual desire. If your desire is intense, it is quite impossible that the light should not come to you. The question of whether the path is long or short must not be allowed any room in your mind. That is why Rameshji would say your head is already in the tiger's mouth. It's too late. Peace of mind is your destiny. Try as you may to avoid it. Okay. If anyone wants to share anything, they are welcome to raise their hands now. Yes, Uttara.
Namaste, Gautamji. How are you?
Namaste, namaste. I'm good.
Unbeknown to me, today was solar eclipse, and I had the pleasure of seeing you twice today. Uh-huh. So obviously it's two folds for me. So thank you. I attended your earlier session. So I'm from New Zealand. Uh-huh. So the time difference means it was today.
What time
this
is it there now?
It's about, I think, it's about 5:35 in the evening.
Okay.
And we had the session at 4 o'clock in the morning with the Course in Miracle. So, yeah, so it's exactly, it's on the same day. So I just wanted to share, yes, it has been twofold for me. So thank you very much. From the earlier session, just wanted to ask you one question. Just, it's probably my conditioning that I've been brought up that way or led to believe that way, that when three things you discussed is about karma, about prarabdha karma, and also forgiveness. And I just wanted to see how they two are connected. For example, if a person slaps me on the face, I get the pain, I feel the pain, and that action has happened. So that is a karmic bondage between both of us. So if I don't forgive this person and forget the incident, would I not be carrying it further with me, with no sense of ego, but just carrying it with me for the next birth or with me throughout this life, and I'm creating a karmic bond with this person?
So let's focus on only this life, because we have enough on our plate for this life.
Yep.
So if someone slaps you, it was obviously meant to happen because you could not control it, right? You didn't know the other person is going to slap you. You got slapped.
Yep.
So that was, you could say, God's will, the will of the source, you got slapped. Now, all you can do is exactly what you think and feel you should do in the situation. Now, two possible outcomes are there. One is, depending on your nature, you slap back immediately, right? Now, someone who is timid, who is docile, may not have the ability to do that, you see? And that person might just be too stunned to respond in that way. Okay. So that person is doing what is in their nature to do again. Now, where does this issue of karma come in? Karma means action. The problem is not the karma. The problem is the doership associated with the action. This is what the whole Bhagavad Gita is about. That it is not the action, it is the ego deluded thinks I am the doer. He slapped me, so I must slap him back. He did this to me, therefore I must do that to him. That is what we were talking about, action-reaction loop. The action-reaction loop perpetuates the bondage of karma because it is based on doership. Now, there's no thing here of, is it right to slap him back or not? Everyone acts according to their nature. Now, if the sense of doership is removed from the equation, which only the person of understanding will have, then that person is free to even slap back because there is no sense of doership associated with that. Please understand this, because it is a subtle point. If my nature is not to slap back, but I am struggling and forcing myself to slap back, that is a heightened sense of doership because it's against my nature. I will give you one example. In Ramana Maharshi's ashram, when it had just started, some burglars came. And his few devotees that were there woke up, and Bhagwan woke up, and he said, what are you all doing? They were going to get big rods and sticks and all that. The robbers came, and Bhagwan said, look, just forget all this. Let them take what they want. So the devotees were a bit perplexed, and then he explained to them, look, it is the nature of the thieves to take. But is that your nature? Is that really your nature? This is what he was trying to point to, you see. So as an individual, if I am slapped after the incident, the understanding can only be two types. He did something to me, so I hate him, or I was meant to be slapped and therefore I got slapped. This does not change my response, whether I slap the person or I don't slap the person. What is meant to happen will happen. But there's the understanding operating. So even if I slap the person back, it is not going to play on my mind for the next 3 days as something I did. Oh God, I should not have done that. Why did I do that? God was testing me. That is all the dialogue of the thinking mind, you see. So all this action becomes pure, and the reaction becomes pure when the sense of doership is removed. Things are seen objectively. I hope that answers your question.
Yes, yes, it does. Thank you.
Now, the point is, if someone slaps you and you slap the person back and you can go on doing this 25 times repeatedly, is that really fun?
No.
You see, not. That is why Eckhart Tolle, the author of A New Earth and The Power of Now, said something about relationships. He said, sometimes it takes one out of the two partners to be the witnessing presence in the relationship. So when one partner's pain body is active, all the psychological suffering, trauma, and so on, rather than constantly arguing back and forth, if one stays as the witnessing presence, then the tennis ball is not hit back. Then the other feels there's no resistance to what is being said, and it can throw the other off because they are used to action, reaction. And that space of presence is what transforms the situation.
Thank you, Gautamji.
Thank you. That was nice, the question. If you are in New Zealand, you are living in the future and I'm living in the past. Time is so relative, isn't it?
It is. Yes, you're right. I am in future.
Yes, really. Okay. Yes, Pradeep.
Hey, hi, Gautam. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for taking your time and conducting these sessions. These are really helpful. So I had one simple query in context of understanding the concept, whole concept. So when I started reading I Am That, it was quite difficult for me to, you know, understand the question and answer that are there within the book. But when I went through the recorded sessions of Ramesh ji and the past videos from you as well, so those concepts are quite simple, and I cannot stress enough that, you know, those are quite easy for me to understand. But the next part or next bit which I find difficult is to accept it fully. Like somewhere when I go through these, I get the understanding, yeah, these are quite right. And, you know, these are really simple and this is what it is. I'm not the doer. So the thing is, those concepts are easily understandable, but some point I feel like, you know, I'm not able to digest or fully take it for with me. There is some kind of resistance, and I'm not even kind of understand where is the exact resistance, because I'm able to understand it. It is quite easy to digest as well. And still there is some resistance which I feel somewhere. So I don't know what that exactly is and how I can work on that.
Yes. Pradeep, you have asked a question which is asked by many people. You see, there are people who abuse others, are violent to the others, yet they are drawn to the teaching. And they say, this teaching makes so much sense, but we can't change our reaction sometimes. But we fully resonate with this teaching that nobody truly does anything. It makes so much sense. What has happened is that the teaching has been accepted at an intellectual level. You see, the teaching could also be rejected. If I tell someone nobody does anything, everything is God's will, the person is free to reject it. He does not accept the concept. But someone else says, yes, it makes sense, means the intellect has accepted it. The intellect says, this makes sense, this is a beautiful teaching. Now the question is it translating into life on a daily basis? So we find that we are on various points in our journey. Some will feel that most of the time the teaching is translating, sometimes it's not. Some will feel the opposite, that most of the time it's not translating, sometimes it is. And that is the journey, that is what is called the flip-flop. Because let's not forget that since birth, the baggage and burden of conditioning is so strong that to transform that takes time. So we still see people through our old eyes, through our earlier prisms. We know we are harming people by what we say to them. The intellectual understanding is there that, you know, on one level I feel nobody does anything, yet I'm saying that. That is because that hardwired conditioning is still operating. Now what happens, and this is nothing one can do, except perhaps, as Maharaj would say, contemplate more and more on the teaching. You will find that on its own, the teaching starts sinking in lower and lower and lower. By lower, I mean into the heart. You cannot do that. Your wish is to do that because you have accepted it intellectually. So it is an earnest wish, no doubt. But it can be an exercise in frustration because ego wants an outcome. Ego wants an outcome. It can become a very frustrating exercise. But just look at it objectively. Just sit back one day, think of someone in your life who caused you pain. Now look at it in the light of the teaching. Just see it in that different light. Do things like that, you see. Don't get into each situation you are and why did I react this way, why didn't I react this way. Just keep reflecting on the teaching. Take any example, take any situation which came uncalled for into your life, something you least expected, and just see, my God, as Maharaj said, the expected seldom happens, the unexpected always does. That has been my life's experience. So this acceptance, even accepting that I have the intellectual understanding, but I'm not able to convert it into an action is acceptance. Accept that too. So there's no room for it should be this way. I should be perfect now. I should not be able to, you know, I should not react the way I'm reacting. Drop all that. The teaching has come to you. So that process will happen. It's not going to end at the intellect. It's a question of time. When it happens is not in your control.
Thank you. Thank you, Gautam.
Yes, Jeremy.
Yes, hello. I have a question. There's some teachers say that the goal is to become aware of awareness itself. But I find it very difficult to understand because I think you can only know that you're aware if you're aware of something. So is it not to become aware of the bliss of pure awareness? I just want to check this.
You see, it can be such a tiring exercise to become aware that one is aware. That is the whole point. And that is why I found Rameshji's teaching so practical. Because what he did was, he quietened the thinking mind of the ego by explaining everything in a clear light. And when the thinking mind quietened down, what is left is the bliss of awareness.
Yes.
Your being, without having to be aware of being aware. You see, because then the ego thinks it has to do something to be aware. And many spiritual seekers get frustrated on this point. So I'm so glad you raised it. Because who is going to undertake the practice of being aware? It is the ego. Whereas peace of mind is the absence of the thinking mind of the ego that is trying to be aware. You see?
Yeah, exactly.
So let's keep it simple. The bliss of being.
Exactly.
The peace of being is conscious presence. And I am conscious presence when my thinking mind is disengaged.
Yeah.
Even when I am a surgeon operating on a patient, the awareness is there. The working mind is engaged in the moment with the task at hand, and the thinking mind is set aside. It's a simple, beautiful way to function.
Yeah, it's the same as you addressed it yesterday. Like a lot of people say, you need to love yourself. But I also fail to see how you can love yourself. But you addressed it, you can hate yourself, yes. But
you cannot love yourself because then there are two people. The one being loved and the one doing the loving.
So
I would not say, I mean, how can you say love yourself?
Yeah.
The whole thing is that many people don't want simplicity. When I say many people, I mean the ego. The ego loves steps, processes, complications. You see, now when Maharaj would say that in meditation, consciousness contemplating on itself is non-dual meditation. What he was pointing to is a very simple thing, that throughout your day you are engaged in the outside world. All I'm asking you to do is sit quietly, close your eyes, and just take stock. Be aware that this basic awareness, which is there right now, gets overlaid by all the activity during the day. So for once, just sit and look within at that awareness. And if thoughts come, let them come. Thoughts will come, thoughts will go. So there's no individual doing something. It is just a resting in being, which he would point at, a resting in being. So if you're sipping your cup of coffee, looking out of the window, just enjoying the view outside, whatever it be, you are resting in being. As long as the thinking mind of the ego is not taking you away from that moment. So that is being aware. At least I consider that as the understanding of this.
Okay. Good. Happy that it's cleared. Yeah.
Thank you. Yes, Vandana.
Hello, Gautam. Hello. I wanted to ask you, what is the difference between consciousness at rest and consciousness in motion? Is it something very similar to potential energy and kinetic energy, which we learned in physics?
Yes, absolutely. See, consciousness at rest is potential energy simply because it is not dead matter. It is potential energy because the potential of it is to get activized at some point.
Mm-hmm.
So consciousness is consciousness. Consciousness at rest is the unmanifest consciousness, And when the manifestation is there, it is consciousness in movement, in action. And in our daily lives, consciousness is impersonal consciousness in deep sleep, because in deep sleep, I don't know that I exist. And in the waking state and the dream state, it is personal. I am Vandana. I am Gautam. Even in my dreams, I'm separate from the others. So they are two sides of the same coin. The coin is consciousness, impersonal consciousness in the deep sleep state and identified consciousness in the waking and dream states. So consciousness is all there is.
So is nature a manifest form of consciousness?
Nature is a manifest form of consciousness within consciousness. You see, there cannot be anything outside of consciousness, because then that would be two. And that is why the manifestation, and pure manifestation is nature, right, is a reflection of consciousness within itself. Within itself. So that is why they say even the manifestation is Brahman, is God, because it is within the source, not outside the source.
Thank you.
Consciousness at rest is Shiva, and consciousness in manifestation has become Shiva Shakti. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you.
Sorry, Rahul.
Hi, Gautamji.
Hello.
Good morning. It's really nice that we're having these weekly meetups, and it's really giving me a spiritual boost. Mm-hmm. So thank you for that. My question is about concentration and focus. Like when you're doing something, sometimes, you know, you don't have thoughts. You're just so totally into the task of doing something, especially at work or something like that. Isn't that the product of the mind? Isn't that which the mind generates? Or is it something else which keeps the thinking mind silent?
You see, Rahul, I've given this example, which I often give, which my teacher often gave, which explains it very clearly. A surgeon conducting a surgery, his working mind is totally engaged in the job. His years of experience are brought at hand to conduct the current operation in the best possible way. It's not that he has no mind, right? Now what happens is a fellow doctor tells him before the surgery, look here, you be very careful with this patient, because he is related to the politician who rules this land. If something goes wrong, you had your chips. And now while doing the surgery, there's a moment where the surgeon feels, my God, and he starts sweating, I better be careful. That is the thinking mind, which has taken him away now from pure focus, which is the focus of the working mind. So it is the mind. The working mind, which is not distracted by going into the dead past or an imaginary future and wondering what will happen, what might happen, fear. It is the pure mind at work. When the thinking mind comes in, it brings in the fear of consequences. What if? And creates multiple scenarios. And then what happens? The surgery is no longer performed in the best and most optimum way, because the thinking mind got involved. So is the surgeon concentrating while doing the surgery? In the sense that the working mind is engaged, not in the sense that he is doing concentrating. Because that can be very frustrating, to concentrate, focus as a sense of doership is very straining on the system. But when the mind is vacant of unnecessary thinking, the pure mind is operating. I'll tell you a joke which I saw a cartoon strip. So a surgeon is telling the patient, "Don't worry, Michael, it will all be okay." So the patient looks up at the surgeon. He's quite scared. He says, "But I'm not Michael." So the surgeon says, I know, I am." He was telling himself not to worry, you see. So I hope this is your question. So this is actually a big pointer here, this word concentration, because this teaching is not about the concentration perhaps other teachings encourage and point at, because this teaching deals with clearing the garbage of a mind full of thoughts, of consequences, of future, of the toxic past. It believes in clearing all that so the vacant mind is available, not as an effort of focus, concentration done by an individual ego. So it could be that some people are drawn to the path of concentration in that sense, and that might work for them. Different strokes for different folks. But this teaching does not look at concentration in that light. Okay?
Okay. Just one more question. Does samadhi mean concentration, or does it mean like, I don't know. I always had this, I kept Googling it. What does samadhi actually mean?
You see, it could be a question of semantics, because samadhi is given different meanings in different teachings. But let's keep it simple. When the mind is at rest, it is samadhi. Then there are stages of samadhi. But for us simple beings, when the mind is at rest, when something happens, it is witnessed. And when there is nothing to witness, the mind slips into samadhi. Basically, the witnessing state becomes the non-witnessing state. Let's take an example. I am standing by my window, sipping my cup of chai, and I'm looking at the traffic go by. I am looking at traffic going by, witnessing is happening of traffic going by. Now there's no traffic. So that witnessing has become non-witnessing. Non-witnessing is samadhi. So the sage, how does the sage live his life? When something happens, it is witnessed. It is not observed. Observing is done by the individual. The individual judges what is observed. The sage witnesses what is happening. And when there is nothing to witness, there is non-witnessing. There is no compulsion on the part of the sage to do things all the time. That non-witnessing is samadhi. Okay?
Yeah, thank you.
There was someone I met, a girl who's, she was given the name Samadhi. You know how sometimes teachers give names and all that? And her mind was so active and she was so talkative. So it was quite ironic that the name Samadhi was there and this was the personality. But you see, there are reasons why teachers give names. Perhaps they see a quality that can emerge or an aspiration. So everything has their reasons. But I'll tell you something very interesting regarding names. Now my younger sister, both are elder to me, but the younger one, her name is Nikki, N-I-K-K-I. It is not a common Indian name, you will agree. I don't know why my parents called her Nikki, but they called her Nikki. Now, it so happened about 10, 12 years ago, we were doing major renovations in the house. And the plaster and cement had to be peeled till the brick. This building is perhaps 70 years old now, where we stay, maybe more. 80 years old, I don't know. And what was unbelievable was when the brick was exposed. You see, some bricks have the name which is engraved in the brand name of the brick is kind of, you know, engraved in the brick itself. And those bricks were called Nikki, N-I-K-K-I. Only difference being that the two K's were facing each other like that. Unbelievable. So was the name destined to be Nikki? Who knows? But see, all these names are vibrations. Nothing happens by chance. Everyone's name. All your life, you are called by that name, by that vibration. That is the beauty of names. Everyone's name. My spiritual teacher, he went for palm leaf reading. You might have heard of that, Nadi astrology. When they ask you a few questions, and if they find the correct leaf, they tell you about your life. And the palm leaf reader told him that your name is Ganesh Balsekar. And he said, right now it's Ramesh, but my mother did call me Ganesh at birth and then changed it to Ramesh. Isn't that incredible? Okay. Yes, Indira.
Namaste, Gautam.
Namaste.
How are you doing?
Good.
So I just remembered when you said Nadi astrology, even I had been there. And it looks like my leaf wasn't found, but somehow they made it up, I felt. Okay, so my question was, I was reading this text called Kashmir Shaivism. So initially it started very nicely, like how the universe is formed and what are the elements and things like that. Slowly it went deeper and then it got totally complex. So we go from objectivity to subjectivity and deeper levels of subjectivity. So my question is similar to that of Jaron, where when you're in deep sleep state, that consciousness, how do you identify or remain with that consciousness in deep sleep state?
Who is asking that question? The ego is asking the question that how can I be my absence?
Yeah.
Deep sleep is the absence of the one that is asking the question.
How is that state achieved?
The state is achieved by forgetting about it. What we have to look at is our waking state. Ramana Maharshi did say that deep sleep is your natural state. What was he referring to? The stillness of the mind, the resting in the self. So understanding the ego, the way it operates, what takes it away, what are its projections, what are its illusions based on doership. He gave that very common example of the Gopurams in the temple, the carved statues in the South Indian temples, which are carved so that they are looking like they are holding the pillars of the temple on their shoulders. And then they think, I am holding the pillars of the temple on my shoulders. That is what the ego does. It is just one beautiful carving where nobody does anything. So the deep sleep of the dream state, which is the absence of the ego, in the waking state, the ego cannot disappear. You have to operate as the ego, otherwise people will call your name and you won't respond. So the ego is the operating element in the waking state, but the sense of doership is uprooted from that ego. in the sage will respond to his name being called. He's not going to just sit like a zombie. If his devotee calls up, he'll say, yes, what is it? That is the ego. Identification with name and form as a separate entity. But when the sense of doership is removed, then that separation between me and the other falls away. That is coming as close to deep sleep as is possible in the waking state.
So during the waking state, can we do something or something like maintaining awareness so that in the deep sleep state you actually experience the thoughtless state?
I kept saying from the start, let the teaching do this job. Let the teaching do this job. What can you do? As Maharaj had said once, because his people were pushing him to give them practices, he gave them a very simple practice, simple in appearance. He said, change the internal dialogue in your mind. When you see something, change the dialogue from I see something to something is seen. Change the dialogue from I hear something to something is heard. What is this exercise? It is giving a neutral vision, not based on something happening to me, which all our day goes in this focus on me as a separate entity. I see something becomes something is seen. I hear something means something is heard. It is no longer taken personally by the ego with its sense of doership.
Thank you.
The mind is at rest then, you see. If someone abuses you, the instrument through whom the abuse happens becomes irrelevant. Because you are no longer dissecting people in your life and saying this one is this, that one is that, that one is that. The vision transforms.
Another question I had it's also mentioned that Shiva is everywhere and also nowhere. I understand that Shiva is everywhere, which is the manifestation, his own manifestation, and all beings are in that consciousness. How do I understand that he's nowhere?
Between what your eyes are seeing and what they see, what is there? Between your physical eyes and the object they are seeing, what is there?
I think it's consciousness.
Is it an object?
No.
So conscious is nothing and conscious is something. Apparently our bodies, the scientists say, are 90% space between the atoms. Look at the illusion.
Okay.
Most of us is nothing.
Okay, it's mostly it is nothing. So.
Most of us is nothing. Look at the space between the stars and the sky. Most of it is nothing. There is more of nothing than there is of something. But our attention falls on the something and then blows that something out of proportion. And then we make something out of nothing.
That's true.
So next time someone says something you don't like, just tell yourself that they are telling it to 90% of nothing, not to me.
Yeah, good one. Thank you.
Okay. You might like to read one essay I had written called Nothing and the Centaur. It's in the book Explosion of Love. So if you are exploring the subject of nothing, that might be of interest to you. Yes, Holger.
Yes, thank you, Gautam. It's now after 11 o'clock here in California in the night. And it was so beautiful. In the morning, I had a Zoom satsang with Roger. And then an hour later, I saw you. And then now I see you again. And in the meantime, I heard Eckhart Tolle. He also had some live event. I mean, it's so amazing. There's so much beauty and gratitude here. It's wonderful. I just wanted to say thank you. And your words deeply resonate in me. And I really appreciate it.
Actually, Holger, you have mentioned two people very dear to me. And Eckhart was for me a very big catalyst on my spiritual journey. And I'll tell you something quite funny. Years ago, when I was in advertising, and the kind of, you could say, not only was the business falling apart, but I was losing interest in it. And at that time, my sister, me, and some friends met Eckhart quite often. And I told him once, I said, you know, Eckhart, I think my interest in advertising is dropping away. And his reply was two words. He said, thank God. You see, so his book, The Power of Now, was deeply transformational for the world at large. And when he came to India after it was launched, we went to Thiruvannamalai, to the Ramana Ashram, because that was his wish. We spent some beautiful moments together. And I must say that, you know, as my teacher would say, living the teaching can be sensed in a person. Walking the talk, and so on. And I found that here was someone who was really a shining example of what he spoke and wrote about. And the context in which the writing took place, the structure, the presentation. You see, I met many Indian sages. I must tell you, the Indian sage's spiritual ego is not really small. So many of them started saying, oh, you know, this is an ancient Indian message, being in the now and all. This one Westerner has written it. My point was, can you write as well? This ancient message, the presentation is so beautiful that it has a direct impact on so many people's lives. It's a fantastic gift to the world. So that is Eckhart. And Roger has been, for me, the phrase I used of Guru Bhai, Guru Brother. We've shared time with the same master. And I think we were friends right from his first visit. I don't remember when that is, but he would come very often, every couple of months, because he had got the Advaita bug. So he would fly down from Australia and then we would meet over lunches and dinners, and he'd come home, and then we started holidaying together. So thank you for bringing them into this satsang, because it only can add a smile to my face. Eckhart was scheduled to come to India early next year. And it all depends now on the coronavirus situation. We are hopeful that it will happen. If he does come, he would likely give a talk in Mumbai. This is for everyone else listening to this, in case it interests them. And yes, that's about it. So I think we can end on this note. And I would like to add here that I don't know if it's premature, but I think my team, Sangeeta, Divya, I think Sangeeta is working on this also, that these Sunday talks, one of the Sundays coincidentally falls on Guru Purnima. Guru Purnima is the full moon dedicated to the Guru. And what I decided to share, because I had free time during this lockdown, is my thoughts on Siddha Rameshwar Maharaj. He was the guru of Nisargadatta Maharaj. And I found his teachings beautiful. So I started sharing his quotations, which impacted me. And I could see the stream, you know, the lineage or the stream or whatever you call it, where Nisargadatta Maharaj was coming from. And this will be offered as podcasts freely for anyone who's interested in them. They're just 10 minutes each, so they don't take up much of your time. And so I think on 5th July, I hope I have that Sunday date correct, but it's the Guru Purnima date. That is when it will be released. And perhaps on that Sunday, we can just focus on this beautiful gift of spiritual teachers. And they needn't be sages. It could be someone in your life who's taught you so much of life's journey. It could be a family member. It could be a colleague at work. They are all our teachers, you see. So I just thought I'd bring that up. And now if we can just end on a couple of minutes silence, and I'll switch the view so I can see all of y'all. Times are challenging. This entire year, in all probability, is a challenging one. The anchor is the wisdom teachings, which take the boat through these rough waters. The grace of the guru is the grace of not an individual. It is the grace of consciousness. And we are already in its embrace. And as the mother of Pondicherry would say, have faith in the grace and have no fear. When fear arises, witness the fear as a movement in consciousness. Have no fear does not mean to stop fear. It means to witness fear as one movement amongst many. The fear of survival, of me and my story. Be willing to let go of your story. Surrendered into the hands of grace.